This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, the Silicon Valley Bank. What lessons learned? I welcome Chris Riegel, the CEO of Scala.com. Scala, a global technology firm transforming the retail space with digital signage. This is the Scala Report. Chris, I learn from Emily de Liberiere of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies that SVP is a moment in its failure that the PLA, in particular the enterprising young people at the People's Liberation Army who use digital information to purloin more digital information, this is an opportunity for them to move in and learn a deal about what's going on in startups and mature companies in Silicon Valley Bank. And the example Emily gives me is a company that was making batteries more than a decade ago called A123 that eventually went bankrupt, went away, but it was acquired by a Chinese company that got with it a lot of intellectual property rights that otherwise wouldn't have come to the Chinese and was a window on other battery makers. This is 2010 during the Great Recession. Ms. de Liberiere pointed out that SVP is a fire sale and that large Chinese companies associated with the Chinese Communist Party love fire sales. And in the breakup, we're likely to see advantages for the Chinese that wouldn't have come about if it hadn't failed the bank. And she noted one instance where the UK version of SVB has now been purchased for €1, I believe, or maybe it's £1, by HSBC, a very large international bank with offices in Hong Kong, the chief shareholder of which is an esteemed member of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, I tell all these anecdotes because you see from another point of view your many trips to Silicon Valley. Is Silicon Valley aware that when companies fail or when SVB exposes its depositor list, the bad actors in China are taking advantage of it? Good evening to you, Chris.
Good evening, John. For some time, it's been the case that bad actors around the world are still enchanted by the opportunities within Silicon Valley. So you can look at SVB as an example, and whether that be CCP or others being able to gain influence, gain insight, buy influence. You also have other banks like Sberbank, the Russian bank, who were large investors in Uber originally. So tech and what you'd call the new Silk Road surrounding tech has very much been a focus of bad actors around the world because it's highly profitable. And with the SVB failure, there could and will be assets that are in play. And the CCP, being smart, will try to take advantage of that.
And so what we're seeing is business as usual. Emily de Liberiere gave me to understand that this has been going on for some time and the vulnerability is well known in Silicon Valley. Your many trips there. Do people joke about how the Chinese are sitting on their shoulders? Do they joke about how they're losing intellectual property rights through many avenues?
I think the Valley in many ways is an amazing place, but there are some problems occasionally, and short-sightedness tends to be one of them. Within that short-sightedness for tech companies trying to start up, trying to get to a public market, unfortunately, in many cases, they may be taking money from less than desirable partners and may not think about that long-term interest from a political or governmental side. That being said, it is a free market economy for the moment. So the ability for companies to take money from different investors or different banks has been one of the great advantages of Silicon Valley to accelerate tech innovation. We'll see how that evolves in the next several years.
I note that in testimony to Congress, the Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, was obliged to acknowledge that some of the investors who were protected by the decision to protect all depositors at once over $250,000 limit, some of those depositors were accounts associated with the Chinese Communist Party. And that's okay. One part of the government tells us that China is a near peer adversary. The other part of the government says it's capitalism. We protect everything, including Chinese Communist Party money.
It's curious, though, to think if the bank failure were a bank in Tulsa or Knoxville or somewhere else in the U.S., would the treatment have been the same? Silicon Valley Bank was definitely a bank of the privileged, for the privileged, by the privileged. So we'll see if equal treatment occurs in the next bank failure.
We move to recovery because we're of the business of looking for positive stories, not just what happened to SVB and how many bad things were kept behind closed doors until the failure. We look to a headline, however, in Bloomberg that Chris brings to my attention. Chris, you've been talking some time about commercial real estate and the pandemic, and especially work from home. The headline here is, where stress is building in the $20 trillion commercial real estate market. Here's something to be anxious about. You've been anxious about this for some time. The driver of this, I believe, is that the office towers are empty, not just in New York City and San Francisco, but across the country. Is there a remedy? Have the owners of the commercial real estate come up with, what, a bad bank or some way around the fact that the rents are coming due?
John, not yet, but this is another looming challenge on the horizon. So if you think about in the SVB failure, the fundamental trigger of repricing assets in a mark-to-market causing a sudden loss of liquidity and a run on the bank, there's $400 billion worth of commercial real estate loans coming due here in 2023 on office towers that these loans were taken out pre-pandemic at full occupancy at very high per square foot rates that have now changed. So you have another potential systemic problem coming in the commercial real estate market in the hundreds of billions of dollars, if not into the low trillions of dollars, where as assets are repriced, all of a sudden good notes are now bad paper and a problem that will have to be solved somehow.
A banking problem as well. I see that because those regional banks must hold a deal of that paper of what used to be really prime real estate. And now, Chris, I go to another metric that I believe applies to what you've been identifying. This is subway ridership in Manhattan. You couldn't be more parochial than this. Okay. Times Square, Grand Central, 34th Street, Herald Square, and Union Square, all associated with the high-end buildings of Manhattan. Subway ridership from the boroughs, from Jersey, supporting those buildings. The numbers are surprising. This is compared to 2019 weekly average. Right now, 2023, Times Square is at only 36% of 2019. Grand Central, which is the crossroads of the galaxy, at 33%. Herald Square, 31%. Union Square, 33%. I'm going to make a leap and see if you agree with it. I believe that ridership must be the people who used to occupy those prime buildings of commercial real estate, and that those buildings are not restored despite the fact the masking is gone. The pandemic is understood as, if not solved, certainly we can live with it. And there's no reason to believe those buildings are going to have a sustainable future. Am I making too big of an assumption of this fall off in ridership?
So, John, I think it's a very reasonable assumption. Now, the question going forward for those companies is, if you're not going to order employees back to the office, do you need the same amount of office space? And what does that do to the rate of office space? That rate then translates to building value, translates to property taxes, translates to secondary service businesses all around those city cores. So you're looking at potentially a fundamental reset into the revenue models, both in that commercial real estate market, as well as the municipalities who survive off of that commercial real estate tax. And that could have big waves of disruption over the next decade.
Can you order people back to the office? Can it happen? Or is there a revolt? In Washington, for example, Chris, that when the departments try to order people back, they move to a department where they're not ordered back. Is that going on that you've heard in tech?
It's definitely going on in tech. There are announcements earlier this morning about Apple further pushing to have people back. John, I think as an employer, you can't order people back when there's 1% unemployment rate. At 4 or 5% unemployment rate, you can. And employers going into this recession are increasingly having power come back to instructions on coming back to the office or else. And those or else moments will be the interesting pivot points in the economy to see where that new balance between worker and company exists.
The recession, the one waiting for a recession, waiting for Godot. Is it here yet, Chris? You see business to business. Can you see the diminution in passion about the future?
It's certainly here. We're seeing in the hospitality and service sectors bankruptcies now accelerating, and that being a key point. So yes, the recession is here. It is underway. It's probably been underway for the last 9 to 12 months. How long and how deep it will be is the open question.
A colleague of mine brings to my attention that the least among the middle class are seeking to equity loans on FHA and VA mortgages. Do you see anything comparable, people borrowing money to make ends meet now?
Credit card debt continues to spiral on the consumer side. Late payments on credit cards continue to be a problem. That's in the face of the highest interest rates in a generation. So it's clear that the consumer is under greater pressure, and you're starting to see the diminution of ancillary purchases, large format televisions, gaming consoles, et cetera. Things that people can live without are starting to fall in sales volume, and that's a problem for the economy.
Chris Riegel is the CEO of Scholar.com, a global technology firm. This is the Scholar Report. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.